Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. We're kind of in the last phases of the North Carolina debates, but we're going to be diving straight into today will be regarding the Supremacy Clause. This puts into context the Supremacy Clause that so many people have created this mystique that the federal government is supreme in anything and everything they deem necessary and proper. And as a matter of fact, that concept came from, let me see, the first judicial Supreme Court justice that asserted that was John Marshall. And he did that in 1816, Maryland v. McCullough. The concept that the Supreme Court is, or not the Supreme Court, that the federal government is supreme in anything and everything they deem necessary is just contrary to how the Constitution was defined at the ratification debates. Now, to be very clear, anybody that is looking at the Constitution and kind of understands those words doesn't necessarily fall into the, you know, the easy trappings. However, when you're dealing with somebody like John Marshall, when you're dealing with some of these men, they were able to outwit and convince the public and everybody else reading the exact same thing that that was precisely what it meant. So anybody, any conservative entertainer, anybody out there that says, all I need is the Constitution, just remember that the Constitution has been bent and twisted and perverted because people have only used the Constitution. This is why the ratification debates clearly delineate and define those meanings of these mystical clauses and every line that is of question of importance especially. But as you know, the show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. And we have this posed problem, solution, issue that we have posed to you. Are you a part of the problem? Or are you a part of the solution? And as I've said, and I kind of ran it pretty good yesterday, that if you are not a part of the solution, then you remain as a part of the problem. The solution grows and continues to move when people become a part of it. If nobody steps in, then it is the same thing. And basically, it is the actualization of Edmund Burke's citation or quote when he says, the only thing for evil to succeed is for good men to do nothing. And so are you doing nothing? Because our Constitution has been subverted. And if we do not step in and demand compliance, it will fail. We and our constitutional republic and our liberties will fail. And we will be then entrapped into a state of communism. If you want to see how communism really works, just look at the scorched earth mentality that the left possesses towards anything that is opposing them. Now, so one of the things that you can do, one of the ways you can become a part of the solution is assisting with the listener drive and trying to grow this show. We just beg and plead that you talk to like-minded people, people that maybe seem indifferent. Maybe they, you know, they're good people, but maybe they're just indifferent. Give them the access and opportunity to understand the truth, and maybe they too will become a part of the solution. I dare think that people would rather be a part of the problem than continuing doing what they're doing nothing, once they've been exposed to the truth. So with that, I know that there's this high likelihood of jonesing. Things are just going on and on. And, oh, I got to tune in. What the heck's happened? I need my fix. that's what jonesing is all about, right? That's what they referred to back in the days when people, well, actually today, heroin is still a real problem. And so I guess they still probably use the term jonesing, but it was just one of those new words added to our vernacular because of the 60s and the 70s. But anyway, let me just, oh, actually, I want to remind you that we do have a listen line. If you cannot tune in, you can still get the good word on dialing our listen line. All you've got to do is dial 605-562-4209. And with that, we are going to get straight into Mr. Iredell's comments regarding the Supremacy Clause. Because what ends up happening is as they were reading through the Constitution, they debated it. And so there was this reply, that reply, and in the last particular case, they were talking about the Article 5, the Amendment Clauses in Article 5 of the Constitution. And so now they've read Article 6, the first clause, and nobody said anything. Then they read the second clause, and this causes pause, and Mr. Iredell says this: "This clause is supposed to give too much power when, in fact, it only provides for the execution of those powers which are already given in the foreseen articles." I'm going to read this again because right there, the very first sentence, he hits it out of the park. "This clause is supposed to give too much power when, in fact, it only provides for the execution of those powers which are already given in the foregoing articles." What does it say? And he says this, and he actually cites it, quote, "This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof," in other words, these enumerated powers and the laws necessary to executing those specific powers, "and all treaties made which are made," "which shall be made in the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding." And so, in other words, if there's any contradiction to this law and laws of the states or so forth, and I want to clarify, people think that, oh, all we've got to do is just pass this treaty and then we can, you know, like, here's a good example. The federal government created treaties with the, let's say the UN, and the UN basically said that, hey, you know, we want this this gun control law to be, make a treaty with this. Well, now, so you got to understand that the federal government has to have that check writing ability. In other words, they have to have those powers and those oversights. So when it comes to importing goods and so forth, and somebody comes along and says, we want to make a treaty that you can't import or export your dairy. Okay, well, that's something that the federal government actually does control. So they can control those types of commerce treaties. Maybe they can control the commerce treaties of the selling of arms, but they cannot give away the whether you can own a weapon. If the UN creates a treaty with the United States government that the people will be disarmed, that would be a violation of a power that they do not possess themselves. It's tantamount to them basically getting a hold of your checkbook and writing checks with your checkbook. It's called fraud, and they have no power to do so. So you got to understand that these treaties may become the supreme law of the land only if the federal government has the cognizance and the enumerated powers over those things that they made in that treaty. Okay, so anyway, he goes on and says, "What is the meaning of this? But that as we have given power, we will support execution of it. We should act like children to give power and deny the legality of executing it. It is saying no more than that. When we adopt the government, we will maintain and obey it in the same manner as if the Constitution of this state had said that when a law is passed in conformity to it, we must obey that law. I mean, if you have any questions regarding the Supremacy Clause, this is one of the better ones that actually defines the Supremacy Clause. Would this be objected to? Then when the Congress passes a law consistent with the Constitution, it should be binding on the people. If Congress, under pretense of executing one power, should in fact usurp another, they will violate the Constitution. I presume, therefore, that this explanation, which appears to me the plainest in the world, would be entirely satisfactory to the committee. And as far as I'm concerned, it resonates with me. But guess who stands up? Mr. Bloodworth, hey, going through one ear and out the other guy. Mr. Chairman, I confess his explanation is not satisfactory to me. I wish the gentleman had gone farther. I readily agree that it is given them no power than to execute their laws. And so that's at least a good concession on his part. But how far does this go? It appears to me to sweep off all the constitutions of the states. It is a total repeal of every act and constitution of the states. The judges are sworn to uphold it. It will produce an abolition of the state governments. Its sovereignty absolutely annihilates them. And so he gets into this absurdity again. We will get back into this and Mr. Iredell's, backhanding of him right after these two promos. So please stay tuned. We'll be right back after this. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobius Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobius Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
I'm sitting here wanting to just kind of turn that off so I can just jump into, start explaining this. But what I want to do is I want to read Mr. Bloodworth's comment again. He says, I wish the gentleman had gone farther. I readily agree that it is giving them no more power than to execute their laws. In other words, it's not creating any power to the federal government than those things that are enumerated. Then, in the same breath or in the same, you know, comment or complaint, he says, but how far does this go? It appears to me to sweep off all the constitutions. No, that's not what it... He clearly said that it gives them no power to do so. Where in the Constitution does the federal government have the ability to annihilate the state governments? It doesn't. The states only delegate these very specific powers. They haven't basically, you know, surrendered and have centralized all the powers to the federal government. So anyway, Mr. Iredell stands up and kind of backslaps him by saying this: Mr. Chairman, every power delegated to Congress is to be executed by laws made for that purpose. It is necessary to particularize the powers intended to be given in the Constitution as having no existence before. But after having enumerated what we have given up, it follows, of course, that whatever is done by virtue of that authority is legal without any authority or power. So, in other words, these powers of the Supremacy Clause only, and I emphasize, only apply to the enumerated powers. When John Marshall and other people started making these bald-faced lies that says, oh, well, the Supreme Court and the federal government is supreme in anything we deem necessary, that completely contradicts how the Constitution was defined. And they knew it. These liars, these nefarious men knew it. The question then under this clause will always be whether Congress has exceeded its authority. If it has not exceeded it, we must obey, otherwise not. This Constitution, when adopted, will become a part of our state constitution, and the latter must yield to the former only in those cases. Like I said, he's just hitting it out of the park. Where power is given by it, okay, so in those cases where power is given by it, I'm sorry, I stopped at the middle of that sentence there. It is not to yield to it in any other case whatever. For instance, there is nothing in the Constitution of this state establishing the authority of a federal court. Yet the federal court, when established, will be as constitutional as the Superior Court is now under our Constitution. It appears to me merely a general clause, the amount of which is that when they pass an act, if it be in the execution of a power given by the Constitution, it shall be binding on the people, otherwise not. As to the sufficiency or extent of the power, that is another consideration and has been discussed before. In other words, whether the powers are efficient enough or not. In other words, we've given them the ability to tax us, but is it efficient enough? Or we've given them the ability to call forth a militia. Is it efficient enough? If not, then what? Well, we have to amend the Constitution. See, folks, they've been pulling the wool over our eyes for over 200 years because Marilyn V. McCullough was in 1816. That's over 200 years ago. We've been hearing lies and deceit, and they've been building a facade and a house of cards for over 200 years. Now, the reason why Madison didn't get alarmed when John Marshall made these assertions that the federal government is supreme in anything it deems necessary and proper is because the judiciary had no authority of making laws. They were not legislators. It was drivel. It was opinion flowing forth from the backside of an evildoer. And he didn't, and he knows it was no threat. It only became evil and powerful when other people started injecting, because they said, case law and precedents, that's how our legal system works, and therefore that's, how it has to work in the Constitution. Where the Constitution gave the federal government no ability to use case law and precedents, had they put in front of the states when they ratified this Constitution, that case law and precedents could be used to move what is constitutional, what is not, they would have recognized it as legislating from the bench instead of actually enforcing what is in the Constitution, was not in the Constitution, and given the judiciary an additional powers of sovereignty and legislative powers. And they would have rejected the Constitution on that alone, because they knew that this federal court system would actually start, just like anybody knows, you start self-aggrandizing. They were told that the court had defined limitations. It couldn't exceed its limitations, and they lied and they aggrandized themselves. So what are you going to do about it now? What are you going to do about the federal government self-aggrandizing itself into this monster that it's become? Well, the solution's clear, friends. It's called Republic Review, and it's not a difficult concept. It's basically the states auditing their contract and then going back to their inferior government, because it is only superior in those few things delegated. All the things that have been magically and mysteriously usurped from them can quickly and instantly return. It's just that powerful. It is that powerful. There is no doubt in my mind the divine hand of providence knew exactly what we needed in creating a government. And, you know, okay, so it's on us, and they caused all these problems, and, you know, they've caused a lot of woe. They've done a lot of damage, but we can quickly and easily stop it. Mr. Bloodworth, of course, not being undone for being the most dense person that I have read so far in these debates, says this: "This clause will be the destruction of every law which will come in competition with the laws of the United States." Well, what are those? That, you know, going to war, foreign affairs, importing and exporting of goods? They shouldn't. Mr. Bloodworth is literally being a drama queen in this process. And he says, "Those laws and regulations which have been or shall be made in this state must be destroyed by it if they come in competition with the powers of Congress." Yeah, but those are only defined powers. It is not necessary to define the extent of its operation. It is not the force of our tender laws destroyed by it. The worthy gentleman from Wilmington has endeavored to obviate the objection as to the Constitution destroying the credit of our paper money and paying debts in coin, but unsatisfactorily to me. A man assigns by legal action a bond to a man in another state. Could that bond be paid by money? I know it is not. It is very easy to be wrong. I am conscious of being frequently so. I endeavor to be open to conviction. This clause seems to me too general, and I think its extent ought to be limited and defined. Now, here's the thing he doesn't even realize, that what Mr. Iredell is doing is actually defining it. Because why? They didn't understand contract law in its maturity, that when these guys were saying and further defining these things, and they were writing it down, what was being said by Mr. Iredell, Mr. McLean, Mr. Spate, and Mr. Johnston, and so forth. All of these men were creating amendments to the Constitution defining the terms of the contract. Anyway, his last comment, Mr. Bloodworth is saying, "I should suppose every reasonable man would think some amendments to K were necessary, to the Constitution were necessary." And maybe some of this stuff is really due to shorthands, because it's literally the letter K. And it just didn't get, it got missed in the editing and so forth. But Mr. McLean says this: "Mr. Chairman, that it will destroy the state's sovereignty is a very popular argument. I beg leave to have the attention of the committee. Government is formed for the happiness and prosperity of the people at large. The powers given it are for their own good. We have found by several years' experience that government taken by itself nominally without adequate power is not sufficient to promote their prosperity. Sufficient powers must be given to it. The powers to be given to the general government are proposed to be withdrawn from the authority of the states in order to protect and secure the Union at large. This proposal is made to the people. No man will deny their authority to delegate powers and recall them in all free countries. But, says the gentleman last up, the construction of the Constitution is in the power of Congress, and it will destroy the sovereignty of the states. It may be justified said that it diminishes the power of the states' legislatures, and the diminution is necessary to the safety and prosperity of the people. But it may be fairly said that the members of the general government, the president, the senators and representatives, whom we will send thither by our free suffrages to consult our common interests, will not wish to destroy the state governments because of the existence of the general government will depend on that of the state governments. Anyway, we've got enough time. I just wanted to close that out. We will be right back with what Mr. McLean is saying right after these two promos. Thank you so much. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Okay, so now what Mr. McLean does is he starts explaining this whole concept and makeup of the Constitution and the government that it's creating. And so one of the interesting things is, and I want to, this is going to be a point of a big plug for our First Right, those folks out there trying to get that other amendment ratified to ensuring that the representation of the people is actually being observed. Because how easy is it that your representative, who represents almost a million people, can really represent your interest? Because what ends up happening is they say, well, the majority of my constituents want this, when they probably are lying. But how do you prove them wrong? Unless you're constantly doing polls and surveys and determining exactly what everybody wants. This is why when you allow one representative to represent too many people, it becomes very problematic because all of a sudden they no longer represent us. And they can tell us and lie to us to say, oh, well, I'm representing you, but actually I'm representing the couple of businesses in the district. Now, I understand he who pays the piper calls the tune. And so the businesses typically do pay for that. But this is one of those things where I believe state legislative laws should be created to force the contributions that go to any candidate, the money going to that candidate must be in the jurisdiction. In other words, if it's Walmart, let's just use Walmart for an example. If you have a congressional district and there is no Walmart in your congressional district, then Walmart can't pay you a penny for a contribution as a corporation. Now, let's say there is one Walmart in your congressional district. Then the charge for Walmart, this law that should be created, Walmart would then have to prove that the money it is contributing to this person's candidacy and their election has been raised by that particular Walmart. Because, you know, what is the chances of Walmart taking money that it earns internationally and pours that into our elections? In other words, it creates an unfair advantage for businesses to be able to buy elections in competing with local ma and pa businesses. This is how these global corporations and things have actually taken advantage of our existing system. The easy fix is to require that all money being contributed to any candidate must come from the domain or the the district and or the area of responsibility. If it's a city council, that money has to have been earned and made in that district, in that city, for you to be able to give that. In other words, you have to prove as a business, let's say you have a hair salon and that you got hair salons all over the state and you happen to have a hair salon and you really want to help this one city, get over this line of getting this one candidate in. Well, you can't use the money you made from all of your hair salons. You can only use the money. What this does is it creates not necessarily a nightmare of bookkeeping, but it forces these businesses to actually prove that the money that they're contributing is money that was earned and created and or done within that district, city, the polity for that particular politician, whether it's a water district, educational district, what have you. And see, this is where the unions have been able to backdoor, and then they complain about corporations getting involved. I'm telling you, friends, there is a way to fix this, and that is the mechanism of fixing it. If you want fair dollars to be in your political campaigns, it has to be made and proven that that money came from that district alone, period. And in doing so, you actually protect your representation. Anyway, so this is what Mr. McLean does. He says, but what is the sovereignty and who is Congress? One branch, the people at large, and the other branch, the states by their representatives. In other words, the representatives of the people and the representatives of the state legislatures of the Senate. Do people fear the delegation of power to themselves? To their own representatives? But he objects that the laws of the union are to be the supreme laws of the land. It is not proper that their laws should be the laws of the land and paramount to those of any particular state. Or is it proper that the laws of any particular state should control the laws of the United States? Shall a part control the whole? To permit the local laws of any state to control the laws of the union would be to give the general government no powers at all. It's the same thing as having one city in a state, because it's the most populated city, dictate to the entire state. What he is just clarifying is this paradigm of American republicanism, that representation and that sovereignty is divided based on the interest of the sub-elements of government, not necessarily by the people alone, that it is shared between the sub-elements of government and the people within those sub-elements of government. In other words, you have a county, so that the people deserve at least a minimum of one representative per county. You have a county and its sovereigns, its legislators, the county commissioners, the supervisors. They have a need for representation for the entire county, just like states have the need for representation in the Senate. That is American republicanism, and the beauty of which I think is very, very clear. Anyway, if the judges are not to be bound by it, the powers of Congress will be nugatory. This is self-evident and plain. Bring it home to every understanding. It is so clear that it will force itself upon it. The worthy gentleman says, in contradiction to what I have observed, that the clause which restrains the states from emitting paper money and etc. will operate upon the present circulating of paper money, and that gold and silver must pay paper contracts. The clause cannot possibly have a retrospective view. It cannot affect the existing currency in the manner except to enhance its value by the prohibition of future emissions. It is contrary to the universal principles of jurisprudence that a law or constitution should have a retrospective operation, unless it be expressly provided that it shall. Does he deny the power of the legislature to fix a scale of depreciation as a criterion to regulate contracts made for depreciated money? As to the question he has put of an assigned bond, I answered that it can be paid with paper money. For this reason, the assignee can be in no better situation than the assigner. If it be regularly transferred, it will appear what person had the bond originally, and the present processor can recover nothing but what the original holder of it could. Another reason which may be urged is that the federal courts have no cognizance of such suit. These courts have no jurisdiction in cases of debt between the citizens of the same state. The assigner being a citizen of the same state with the debtor and assigning to a citizen of another state, to avoid the intent of the Constitution, the assignee can derive no advantage from the assignment except what the assigner had a right to, and consequently the gentleman's objections fall to the ground. Every gentleman must see the necessity for the laws of the Union to be paramount to those of the separate states, and the powers given up by this Constitution must be executed. What shall we ratify a government and then say it shall not operate? I want you to be understanding this, that the words that are being uttered by the Federalist in supporting the concepts of the Constitution, what he's saying here, these are the legal binding words. These other concepts of what Mr. Bloodworth, Mr. Henry, and all these other anti-federalists said, those were cast aside, those were ignored, and they did not, because had they actually said, okay, that's the truth, we're not accepting the Constitution. Because they accepted the Constitution, it is because of these positives and what they were told, what these things actually meant by the Federalists. Anyway, this would not be the same as to ratify. As to the amendments, the best characters in this country and those whom I most highly esteem wish for amendments. Some parts of it are not organized to my wish, but I apprehend no danger from the structure of government. One gentleman, Mr. Bass, said he thought it neither necessary nor proper. For my part, I think it is essential to our existence as a nation and our happiness and prosperity as a free people. The people who composed it were men of great abilities and various minds. They carried their knowledge with them. It is the results not only of great wisdom and mutual reflection, but of mutual difference and concession. It has trifling faults, but they are not dangerous. Yet at the same time, I declare that if a gentleman propose amendments, if it not be such as would destroy the government entirely, there is not a single member here more willing to agree to them than myself. Anyway, as you can tell, we're at a hard break. So when we come back, we'll be hearing from Mr. Davey, another Federalist, who actually amplifies some of the things regarding Mr. Bloodworth's, complaints. Anyway, we'll be right back. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
And so, not to be done, Mr. Davey steps up and says this because he wants to offer his perspective regarding the Supremacy Clause. And he says it this way. Mr. Chairman, permit me, sir, to make a few observations on the operation of the clause so often mentioned. This Constitution, as to the powers therein granted, is constantly to be the supreme law of the land. Every power ceded by it must be executed without being counteracted by the laws or constitutions of the individual states. Gentlemen should distinguish that it is not the supreme law in the exercise of a power not granted. I want to emphasize this, that it is not the supreme law in exercise of powers not granted. It can be supreme only in cases consistent with the powers specifically granted and not in usurpations. So maybe what Mr. Bloodworth is more concerned with is just the usurpations and that they would claim these things. But okay, so the reality is that's what's happened. There were usurpations and lies, and they started self-aggrandizing, and they went down this path. So maybe in a way, Mr. Bloodworth was correct that they were going to use lies, but they were violating the Constitution as these men had clearly defined it, because it granted no powers, and even Mr. Bloodworth stated that he acknowledged that it granted no new powers. Anyway, so Mr. Davey says this, if you grant any power to the federal government, the laws made in pursuance of that power must be supreme and uncontrolled in their operation. Pursuant is the key, that it has to be directly tied to that very specific power. This consequence is involved in the very nature and necessity of the thing. The only rational inquiry is whether those powers are necessary, and whether they are properly granted.
And I think he just, you know, nailed it right there. To say that you have vested the federal government with power to legislate for the union and then design the supremacy of the laws is a solecism in terms with respect to its operation on our own paper money. I believe that a little consideration will satisfy every man that it cannot have the effect asserted by the gentleman from New Hanover. The Federal Convention knew that several states had large sums of paper money in circulation and that it was an interesting property, and they were sensible that those states would never consent to its immediate destruction or ratify any system that would have that operation. Now, I want you to understand this right here, that what he is basically saying is that when Hamilton came along and first created the Assumption Act and then created a national bank, what Hamilton was doing was precisely outside of how the Constitution was defined by Mr. Davy right here. Because he basically said that they would not be able to actually go and undo everything that the states have done in the circulating of their own money and their coins and gold and silver and so forth. The mischief already done could not be repaired. All that could be done was to form some limitation to this great political evil. As the paper money had become private property and the object of numberless contracts, it could not be destroyed or intermeddled with the situation, although its baneful tendency was obvious and undeniable. It was, however, affecting an important object to put bounds to its growing mischief. If the states had been compelled to sink the paper money instantly, the remedy might be worse than the disease. As we could not put an immediate end to it, we were content with prohibiting its future increase, looking forward to its entire extinguishment when the states that had an emission circulating should be able to call it in by a gradual redemption. And so it was a process that they were going to maybe extinct, but the fact is that it didn't take that power away from the states. In Pennsylvania, their paper money was not a tender in discharge of private contracts. In South Carolina, their bills became eventually a tender. And in Rhode Island, New York, New Jersey, and North Carolina, the paper money was made as legal tender in all cases whatsoever. So he's just talking about the discrepancies. The other states were sensible that the destruction of the circulating paper would be a violation of the rights of private property, and that such a measure would render the accession of those states to the system absolutely impracticable. The injustice and pernicious tendency of this disgraceful policy were viewed with great indignation by the states which adhered to the principles of justice. In Rhode Island, the paper money had depreciated to 8 for 1 and 100%. With us, the people of Massachusetts and Connecticut had been great sufferers by the dishonesty of Rhode Island, and similar complaints existed against the state. You know, the more I know about Rhode Island, the more I go, you know, how did they ever, you know, operate within the United States? This clause became in some measure a preliminary with the gentlemen who represented the other states. You have, said they, by your iniquitous laws and paper emissions, shamefully defrauded your citizens, the Confederation, prevented our compelling you to do them justice, but before we Confederate with you again, you must not only agree to be honest, but to put it out of your power to do otherwise. Sir, a member from Rhode Island itself could not have set his face against such language. The clause was, I believe, unanimously assented to, and it has only a future aspect and can by no means have a retrospective operation. And I trust that the principles upon which the conventions proceeded will meet the approbation of every honest man. And so we go down a little bit further, and we all of a sudden get into, because Mr. Bloodworth starts talking about ex post facto laws, Mr. Iredell's explanation of ex post facto laws. And he says, "Mr. Chairman, with respect to this clause, it cannot have the operation contended for. There is nothing in the Constitution which affects our present paper money. It prohibits the future, the emitting of any, but it does not interfere with the paper money now actually in circulation in several states. There is an express clause which protects it. It provides that there shall be no ex post facto law. This would be ex post facto if the construction contended for were right, as had been observed by another gentleman. If a suit were brought against a man in the federal court and execution should go against his property, I apprehend he would, under this Constitution, have a right to pay our paper money, there being nothing in the Constitution taking away the validity of it. Every individual of the United States will keep his eye watchful over those who administer the general government, and no usurpation of power will be acquiesced in. The possibility of usurping powers ought not to be neglected against it. Abuse may happen in any government. The only resource against usurpation is the inherent right of the people to prevent its exercise. This is the case in all free governments in the world. The people, and you know, when you hear these guys, then they all say the exact same things. It is not because they had talking points and not that they, you know, had the internet, you know, throwing these things out. The reason they had the exact same words is because they were reading the exact same books. They were all equally informed, and that's why they didn't disagree. Anyway, moving on. The people will resist if the government usurp powers not delegated to it. We must run the risk of abuse. We must take care to give no more power than necessary. But having given that, we must submit to the possible dangers arising from it. And he goes on, with great respect of the weight of the northern states, it will not, on a candid examination, appear so great as the gentleman supposes. Now, we basically just have a minute left. So I just want to really point out to you that this concept of ex post facto laws is being ignored, and we are being subjugated by all sorts of ex post facto laws. As you start looking, and I talk about this all the time, when you look at these water right issues that are happening in the state, the same thing with this bump stock, banning bump stocks and making them illegal, or making long guns illegal, making any gun that you possessed beforehand, as a matter of fact, any gun, period, you cannot make any gun illegal because it infringes on the Second and the 14th Amendment. Neither the state nor the federal government can infringe the rights of the people to bear arms, to take up their responsibility of executing the laws of the Union. Those are responsibilities of all citizens. If you know people that don't have guns, you should be shaming them and saying, you know, how is it that you get away with not executing the laws of the Union? You put the burden on us, and that's how the argument should be going. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. We'll be back with more of these arguments and dialogues from the North Carolina debates in our next episode. God bless. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google Donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty.